I think we're going to start with some meditation. So find a comfortable position for sitting. You know, just sit for maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes, something like that, maybe 30. So we want to start by really just checking in with the body, noticing how it feels. There are lots of different suggestions on how we might position the body, but my experience is that the main thing is that our spine is relatively straight. And if you've had other suggestions that you find helpful, then by all means, follow those. You know, like having your hands folded in your lap or on your tongue to the roof of your mouth, or having your chin level with the floor, those kinds of things to just give us, maybe more than anything, a chance to really check in on different parts of the body and see how they're doing. And if there needs to be a bit of an adjustment to the posture, this is the right time to do it. I feel like it really helps to have an attitude of kindness towards the body. And have that suggestion in the mind that now we're sitting to meditate. This is a sacred act, coming into a sacred space inside ourselves. And see if it feels natural to bring your attention to your breathing, along with the suggestion to establish mindfulness. And what does that mean? You want to be present, observing first the body, and the breath, we breathe in and we are aware that we're breathing in. We breathe out and we're aware that we're breathing out. And it can be very helpful to bring attention to the top of the head, for example, and notice any tightness as we scan down a little bit, any tightness around the eyes, the jaw. And it can be helpful to take a very conscious breath in, and then when you breathe out, to really have the idea of letting go of that tension. Letting go of any doubts or concerns, am I doing this right, or anything else that might be in the back of the mind, just maybe saying to ourselves, now's the time to just set everything aside, to let go. Noticing the shoulders, letting them relax. The arms and hands. Chest and the back. You find usually it's easier to have that feeling of relaxing than letting go on the out breath. Paying attention to the belly. Letting it relax. Legs and the feet. Can we notice if our breathing is shallow or deep? Paying attention to each in-breath and each out-breath. And however the breath is fine. Just observe. And like everything else in this world, the breath will change. And that's fine. We want to be very relaxed, but we also want to be alert. So if you feel a bit drowsy or dull, then put a little more attention on the in-breath, bringing in fresh energy, lightness, enthusiasm. If there's agitation or restlessness, then pay more attention to the out-breath. Letting go, relaxing, releasing. Smiling. And as we're aware of the breath, we can kind of open our sort of space of awareness to take the whole body in at one time. It's kind of like the breath is coming in and filling the whole body. Filling the body with breath energy. The Buddha instructed we should be aware of the whole body, breathing in and breathing out, and calm the body. So with our previous preparation, this should be a natural step. And the body is relatively calm and the attention is on the breath, and we probably will start feeling some pleasant feeling in the body. Just the experience of being mindful brings a sense of ease and calm, pleasant feeling. And the Buddha said, pay attention to or notice whatever pleasant feeling arises. Warmth or tingling, fullness, maybe the subtlest sense of joy, or maybe something much more obvious, apparent. Whatever comes, the attention's on the happiness, the joy. It comes with meditation as we turn inwards, letting go of the world. Still aware of each in-breath and each out-breath. Feeling joy and happiness. Piti and sukha. In whatever form they come. And then we bring our attention to our thoughts. Maybe right now the mind is very calm. And thoughts come slowly. Or maybe not. Maybe there's a lot going on in the mind. And we observe with kindness, with patience, aware of our in-breath and out-breath. We encourage the thought process to become more calm, more peaceful. Knowing that right now there's nothing that we need to do other than be present, happy, contented. This is not a time when we try to get rid of the thoughts. Just invite peace and calm, comfort, comforting the mind. The same awareness that's observing the breath is observing the thoughts in the mind. That awareness itself has no agitation. It has no agenda. Just to be present. As you observe the breath, you don't have to think about it, you can just feel it. You can feel what it feels like to breathe in, and feel what it feels like to breathe out. We don't need that layer of verbal labeling, we can just invite the mind to become happy and still. You said after we calm the thoughts in the mind, we look at the mind itself, the mood, that state. Again, we're not trying to change it or become dissatisfied with it, just observing, just observing. Is the mind free and open, relaxed and calm, spacious? Is it contracted and tight, agitated? Does it have any sense of desire or will inside? Or is it at peace? Not wanting anything, not wanting to get rid of anything. Without hindrances. So whatever you find there, there's nothing wrong. It's just how it is. We can invite the mind to become more happy, more elevated. Perhaps bringing in thoughts that are inspiring and beautiful. Like a reflection on the Buddha. Buddhanicity. The Dhamma. Or the enlightened Sangha. Turning our attention towards Nibbana. Now, instead of ringing the bell, I'm going to give you the option to just stay in this meditative state, to really come out and be away, being present, and we'll share some thoughts about Dhamma. Basically, I think I want to talk about observing, being aware, and bringing our attention to some things that maybe we usually aren't so aware of, that we take for granted. But it's helpful to investigate, to question. And for the purpose of letting go of some of the weight we carry that we may be unaware of. So as many of you know, last week we talked about discernment, really looking at the wholesome and the unwholesome in all of our experience. And I put a lot of attention on a particular issue of gender discrimination. And one thing that can come out of reflecting on the ways in which we as human beings are labeled, or label others, or label situations, or our, even our physical appearance, or whatever categorizing, discriminating, is that we can look more deeply into those concepts. Now, I often mention this sutta, and I think I did last week too, the called the Vaiseta Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's also found in the Sutta Nipata. And it's interesting to me when I look at Bhikkhu Bodhi's course on the Majjhima Nikaya, he doesn't cover this one. I find that interesting because I think it's a little challenging. Maybe it doesn't seem so important. I don't know. I haven't talked to him about why that is. Maybe he had a whole class on it in some other context. Maybe he thought it was really important. I'm not sure. But in this sutta, these two young men of the Brahmin caste were having a disagreement about what really makes you a Brahmin. And you know, the Buddha really kind of redefined what it means to be a Brahmin. So he's talking about those qualities and actions that make us noble. And it's not dependent, well, this argument was about whether or not it's dependent on lineage, birth, or it's dependent on our actions. So the Buddha answers the question by talking about those things that distinguish living beings based on their birth. And he goes through lots of different kinds of living beings and talks about how, you know, four-footed or no-footed animals, living beings, there's a distinction there based on birth. Like you can tell that a cow is a cow based on its birth, and the a dog is a dog based on its birth, and a snake is a snake based on its birth. But he says when it comes to human beings, there's nothing about their bodies, or their, what they come in with because of their birth, that really is worth distinguishing when it gets down to like every part of the body and our color and our hair and our eyes and, you know, even our genitals. So it doesn't matter what gender or, and in one translation, even ways of mating, which is actually true to the Pali, but not usually translated that way. So these are some things that we strongly identify with usually in ourselves. And of course, it goes beyond that. All the kinds of things that we take to be our characteristics that we identify with. I'm this way, or I'm that way. And some of it we're happy with, and some of it we're not happy with. And I was thinking of trying a little exercise. Excuse me. I'm just going to ask you to think of one quality that you would say you have. Just anything. You got one? I did this with Ayachitananda and Anagarika Sarane yesterday. And I found it really, we each picked a quality that we feel we have. So, Kyle, the exercise is to think of a quality that you have. Whatever. That you know, I'm like this. And when the three of us did it, excuse me, when the three of us did it, it was interesting because the qualities we chose could be beneficial or not, either way. They could go either way. I think my quality was particular. I can be a little particular. And what's interesting about these qualities that we, you know, see as part of our identity is that they change. And also that they're kind of a trap. Like, if we think, well, I'm a grumpy person, then, you know, how does that affect us? Or if we think, I'm a happy person, and then, of course, we're not going to be happy all the time. We're not going to be grumpy all the time either. So it's, we can like carry a certain amount of weight and not even know it by having these things we identify with. And maybe not even really feeling our full potential to change. To not be that way. Sometimes we kind of carry these labels that maybe someone else told us we have. It can be a real bummer. and also there's a strong tendency for us to kind of lean in the direction that we think people believe about us. Ajahn Brahm has a couple of stories, if you've listened much to his talks, that he tells, has told frequently about experiments where, you know, you divide a group of young students up and put them in the A group and the B group, but they're actually divided very, like, evenly balanced across their, what's perceived as their abilities, and then sure enough, by the end of the term, the B group is doing much worse than the A group. And it's all in our mind. You know, so we do these things to ourselves too, without knowing. And whatever quality you just thought of, you know, Is this something that's helping you develop and grow and become happier and more free? Or is it something that might be limiting you more, the more you believe in it? So part of this talk is really don't believe what you think. And don't really necessarily believe what other people think of you either. And you know, it's interesting to me to see some of the things that more and more people are questioning that have traditionally, at least in my experience, seemed pretty much taken for granted. And one of those is the idea of gender. So I listened back to the talk from last week, partly because there was a bit of a flurry around it. And that was interesting. And, you know, it's very much focused on men and women. But we encounter more and more people who are really questioning that whole idea of gender identity. And there's really a very beautiful tendency. I don't think I've ever seen it talked about in the suttas, but I think from various traditions, you get this sense that as people become more and more enlightened, they're less and less identified with their gender. So there's a kind of a moving beyond that question of gender and all the stuff that comes with it. So this really, you know, if we look at the process of practice in the Dhamma as fundamentally being based in our presence, in our awareness, in our observing, and that, you know, even in the Anapanasati instructions that the Buddha gave, which is basically what I was working with in the guided meditation, the Buddha says, first you observe the body. You observe, and then you know, invite it to relax. You observe the thoughts, or you observe the feelings, I almost forgot that part. You observe the thoughts, you observe the mind. You know, fundamentally, it's first about bringing awareness to whatever it is. So when we start to support each other and support ourselves and being aware of, you know, what are these fundamental ideas that I've held all this time in my life, maybe for lifetimes? What does it look like if I question, if I just observe? And what do we want to observe? You know, we want to observe the results. What does this contribute to? Is this making me happier, more peaceful, more generous, more kind, more open, more patient, more compassionate, less attached, less caught up in me and mine, in this whole becoming, being kind of process? And so this is like, you know, what does it really mean for something to be wholesome or unwholesome? You know, it has to do with the results. Does it bring us to more peace? Or does it bring us away from it? So we look at something as basic as the five precepts, and it's definitely more peaceful to live by the five precepts. We're more peaceful when we're not harming others or ourselves. We're more peaceful when our minds are clear and we're not intoxicated. We're more trustworthy. We can be still and the mind can be at peace. So when we are bold enough, courageous enough to really question those ideas that we may hold as absolute, we have an opportunity to really gain something. More freedom from the labels. More freedom from being, discriminating against others. More open to real diversity. And maybe through that, we also have more of a sense of what we hold in common, which I think is much more our spiritual selves, if you will, our spiritual non-selves, I guess, and really allowing, and instead of seeing something different or people holding something in a different way and reacting with what probably comes out of fear and discomfort, some negativity or judgment, stepping back and observing. Because when we observe, we're not trying to change it. We're not trying to get rid of it. I listened to a talk by Ajahn Sumedho that he just gave a few days ago, and the title is, "We Don't Get Rid of Our Personality." And it was all about this kind of like, we need to observe. Ajahn Sumedho has been saying a lot of these things for a long time, and finally maybe they're sinking in. he talked about, when we observe something in ourselves, with being aware, we're just being aware. And we're not trying to get rid of something. So, when we see something that we want to change, it doesn't help to go at it aggressively with negativity, trying to squash it. That's the suppression side. That's the aggressive side. It's much more useful to first observe it, like in the Anapanasati Sutta, and then invite it. Just have an intention that what's negative, harmful, downpulling, unwholesome, that we just veer away from it. We don't feed it. We don't stoke that fire. We let it die. In that simile that I tend to love so much about the bonfire with this, I think it's actually like 7 loads of wood on it or something. And the Buddha said, if you keep throwing dry grass, and dry cow dung, which I don't know if you have access to, but onto the fire, twigs, it just keeps going. And if you stop doing that, then it dies down. But he doesn't say, get out the fire hose, it's much more subtle and effective, really, to just stop feeding what's not helpful. So we have some neighbors up in the mountains.
Talking about neighbors.
Talk about neighbors. We got some flowing action going on out there. Sorry. So we have some neighbors up in the mountains that are a young crowd with they're building, cob houses, and, they're doing all kinds of progress, kind of cool stuff. And there's a couple, and they had a baby. And of course, the other guys that lives in the group in that area, on that plot of land, came by, and, we were chatting, and I said, "So is it a boy or a girl?" And he's like, "I don't know. They're gonna let Remy figure it out later." I'm like, wow, that's cool. Yeah, and we can look at, what does this do for us? Or what is what happens in our mind when we're presented with approaches we're not used to? What do we do with that? And that can tell us a lot about what we're clinging to and what we're afraid of. So those are just some thoughts for your reflection. And I'd be happy to hear anything you'd like to say about it or not. No pressure. You can just observe if you want. Did I miss any important points that you want to put in? Anybody? Or any questions or complaints? Kyle?
I just want to say that I'm very grateful for this talk, and I feel so safe as someone who's non-binary, and it just makes me feel a lot of joy and gratitude. And I could really resonate with this idea of grasping towards something, or like trying to push away a part of our personality. For me, in my journey, it's been this, there's been a liberation in becoming non-binary, uncovering my non-binary-ishness, right? There's this, before there was this grasping towards like what the world wanted me to be, like masculinity, and that was very daunting. You know, there's a lot of unrest, and when I figured out who I was, there was this release, there was this peace, there was this non-grasping. I could be whoever I wanted to be, shop wherever I wanted to shop. And there was this, this liberation, and it comes back to that feeling of like what's ultimately leading us to that peace. And being our true selves, I think, is start being aware of that true self. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think there's something here that's important. I mean, I've heard some people, like, there's one Buddhist teacher that I'm thinking of that's very highly regarded, and I actually love them quite a lot. And they've been very frustrated with some of these ideas of what people, especially people in not standing in the hegemony, are struggling with and feeling like, hey, they should just get over it and get rid of their identity and let it all go. You know, that's what we really need to do. And it's like, but that isn't the path to that that we can take. And for someone who's, you know, standing in the space of the hegemony, to say that kind of comes across you know, how can we develop the empathy and the tolerance and the camaraderie in making it a better world and then transcending this whole mess? So that's kind of where I'm seeing it right now. And I think there's a whole lot of space that I feel like I still need to grow into in this understanding. But this is the point we're at. Thank you for those thoughts. Kamatana?
Thank you, Aya. I'm going to talk about a couple of personal things, and if I get a little emotional, please excuse me. It's just something that you know, I've struggled with most of my life. You know, I've this idea of gender has been you know, has been in kind of a question for me ever since I was really young. You know, it's not. I have this trait where I just want to fit in with everybody else. Like, I want to belong, you know, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, I came out to a couple of people when I was young, people found out, and there was a lot of rejection. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm like, okay, so people don't like this, they don't agree with it, so I've got to get rid of it, mm-hmm. so I can be acceptable to others. So, you know, it kind of created this idea that this is not who I want to be. This is not good. And I've tried to get rid of this. I've tried to drink it away. I've tried to drug it away. I've tried to, there was even, some more serious, activity to get rid of this. And, you know, about 10 years ago, I kind of realized that, you know, all this intense conflict within myself is just, I'm trying to get rid of who I am. I'm trying to get rid of me. And it's just, I can't, you know, and this idea, you know, I've been, you know, thinking about, you know, just kind of just giving it up again. And you know, reverting back to an older personality, or, you know, who I was before I transitioned. You know, and the thing with me is that that scares me, like, because I don't want to deal with that conflict anymore. It was so difficult just to come to terms with this, that, you know, like it or not, you know, I ultimately have to live within my own skin. I have to choose to be happy. And, you know, so my point is that, you know, trying to suppress or push this away or get rid of creates more conflict with than just like, okay, this is the way it is, whether I like it or whether anybody else likes it or not, this is just the way it is. And everything tends to settle down a little bit. So, you know, I don't, so that, you know, that question is this more peaceful, or does this more give more conflict? You know, it's something I've been thinking about here lately. And it's like, well, this tends to be a little bit more peaceful. It's a little bit easier. It's a lighter, a little bit more open. Well, then let's just stay with, you know, just,
yeah.
I hope I'm not rambling on, but thank you for letting me share, and you can keep it on recording. It's fine. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Anna, because I'm sure you're not alone. And it's what I'm hoping is that you find more and more people who just are willing to accept you for the wonderful person you are. Mm-hmm. And that the whole gender thing doesn't really matter. I mean, one of the things I like about monastic life, like even in Thailand, when you fill out certain forms, at least I've seen this on forms, when they ask for gender, there's male, female, and monastic. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, monastic life, hey, we got the, you know, every gender kind of outfit, and you got the every gender haircut. You know, you got, like, you're focused on something else. You're not focused on, like, who can I mate with and who can I, you know, like, any of that. And so there's at least an example in the world of something different. And that there are lots of other ways to be different, too, from those stereotypical, rigid gender roles and gender identity and maybe other kinds of roles and identity. You know, based on other characteristics that the world wants to fix into place in order to what? Feel more comfortable or have more order or have more power in some sense. And, you know, hopefully everyone, all of us who are kind of on a different track, you know, like wanting to really explore what's important. So the sutta I talked about, I love the, I hope you read it, number 98 in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I hope you can find it in the Bhikkhu Bodhi's version from 2009, because that's got, the, I think, the more correct translation. And it's, there's a lot of verses at the end about what makes us noble. I can tell you, none of it has to do with gender. none of it has to do with all of those other things that people are so severely criticized for or put down over. And there's, I thought I'd read a little bit to you. It's in the middle of a whole bunch of other things that he talks about that brings nobility to the human being. And it's really awakening, it's full awakening. So, and I see a book opening, it's on page 804, 804 if you've got the book. It's, and I'm just going to start on verse 44 and just read a few of these verses. And this is, the refrain is, this is who I call Brahman. And of course, we got to remember that he's dealing with this caste system and some of its harsh, harsh, harsh realities, and trying to help people drop this idea that you are born into a position in life that you cannot change, and that we're harmed by it, even if we happen to be at what society considers the top. And we don't realize it as much there. We're more blinded by it there. But I'm just going to start on verse 44. Who, pure as the spotless moon, is clear and limpid, and in whom delight and being have been destroyed. And then, unfortunately, Bhikkhu Bodhi's version has he here. He is the one they call a Brahman. If you read Bhante Sujato, he'll say they. And that's where I'm going next. Who has passed beyond the swamp, the mire, samsara, all delusion, who has crossed to the further shore and meditates within the jhanas, is unperturbed and unperplexed, attain nirvana through no clinging. They are one I call a Brahman. Who has abandoned sensual pleasures and wanders here in homelessness with sense desires and being destroyed. They are one I call a Brahman. Who has abandoned craving too and wanders here in homelessness with craving and being both destroyed. They are one I call a Brahman. Who leaves behind all human bonds and has cast off the bonds of heaven, detached from all bonds everywhere. They are one I call a Brahman. And I picked out those verses. I mean, there's a whole bunch before that about the morality of such a person. Let's see. I'm sure the generosity. You're going to get to read it yourself, so. The lack of anger, etc. And then these ones where he says, delight and being have been destroyed. So not that craving, but he goes for delight and with sense desires and being destroyed, craving and being both destroyed. You know, that we're letting go of this sense of self and we're letting go of our cravings and our requirements for comfort in life. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't be comfortable. It just means, can we pry our fingers off of our attachments and be free because of it? And more open and gracious and compassionate and kind. Somebody asked me about how to bring up the compassion and the kindness we were talking about letting go of some very serious stuff that's happening in their life. And they said, I just don't know how to bring up this compassion and kindness. And they said, I think that's going to happen naturally as you let go of the stuff you're clinging to. And I do think that's how it works. Yes, Grace.
I guess it's not so much a question as the metaphor of the fire and not laying on tinder and kindling to it. To me, it feels, in my experience, it feels a little incomplete, actually, because I think the fire goes out when I'm not just not adding stuff to it. It's when I really love that part of me. And I think that applies with gender, like in our household that I share with Kyle. I feel like gender is a toy that we can pick up and put down. And I feel like that happened because when I brought up the idea that maybe I'm not cisgender with Kyle, Kyle was so loving and accepting. And that really allowed me to love that part of myself too and to put it down. And I think that applies to other defilements that I have, that when I shared it with Kyle, Kyle was so loving and accepting, and that helped me put them down. And to the point now where I'm starting to practice doing that for myself has been a very, very rich practice.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And to be fair to the Buddha, I think he was talking about things like anger, you know, and yes, the loving acceptance. So, so valuable. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for, yeah, everyone, thank you for sharing. Yeah, I was thinking about gender. I've been thinking a lot about it as I deepen my practice and like the form and formlessness and everything in between that of this practice. And on that same note of what Grace just beautifully shared, this part of me that sometimes feels really in tune or joyful of identifying as a woman. And I had like some aversion to that sometimes because I was like, oh, am I not, moving towards the practice if I'm so like experiencing so much joy sometimes by this identity. And then sometimes also feeling a lot of joy with this formlessness or non-binary identity as well. And feeling confused a lot as well. And I appreciated this talk because, and what Grace just shared, because it made me realize that it's okay that I like loving this part of me that sometimes really loves being like a woman or identifying that way. And then also loving the part of me that doesn't and doesn't identify or feels nothing around it. And so, yeah, I was like, cause I sometimes I guess I have the thought like, oh, am I not moving towards the practices if I'm clinging to this identity, or I feel like all of my identities and then none of them all at the same time. and so, yeah, that felt really like supportive and kind to be able to move like towards it with love and kindness. And like, oh, yeah, sometimes I really feel a joy and this identity, and that's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, thank you. That's such an important point, because in, you know, it's like when we talk about something in a certain way, it can give the impression that, well, then you're not doing the right thing if you're not on board with that. And that's not the point. The point, I mean, I also really enjoy being a woman. Enjoy is kind of a funny word, but identifying with the qualities that are often associated with the feminine, which we can identify with regardless of what gender we physically have, or the male qualities that are so beautiful that we identify as male. And you know, those qualities, really, what are they? You know, like kindness, compassion, strength, courage, bravery, boldness, whatever it is, whatever we think. And the point being, are the things we're identifying with, are they helping or not?
Yeah.
And when they're not, look at that and see what we want to set down. Or, you know, like you said, Grace, hold lovingly so that things can come into balance. And that balance helps us to awaken more. When Ajahn Sumedho was talking about, you don't get rid of your personality. And, you know, one of the things I hit upon last time we were together was about, you know, even fully awakened and people we recognize as or are recognized as very highly attained, they still have a personality. They still may have things that they are still learning, or that they want to understand about society, or maybe that they don't care about. Thank you. You know, sort of, you know, it's like there's no greed, hatred, or delusion, but there might be things that just are outside their experience. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we don't have to, like, get rid of those things, but we do transcend it. Holly?
Wonderful discussion. I've been listening and thinking, looking back. I mean, I've been kind of riding between genders norms my whole life, and my marriage with Gene, he's pretty feminine. I'm more masculine, whatever. but I wish that this conversation widely in the Buddhist community and our culture could become a non-issue. That's just a dream of mine. Mm-hmm. Because I've had my struggles with being true to who I am in a culture where how I have been at various times has been really different. But I'm a white woman. And that's almost as good as being a white man. And I live in a country that's politically stable, and I haven't had to flee my country or have a dictator destroy it, nearly, but not quite. So I just want to just put that into our conversation of getting up to a higher level and going, there are so many really big problems we have about kindness and cruelty and acceptance and marginalizing and demonizing, and I so wish that how we love and how we present ourselves as humans could just be taken for what we want, whatever we want it to be. So that's my wish.
Yeah, thank you,
Holly.
Neil.
Yeah, so many things have come up for me in this session, and I probably need to sit with them and before I could formulate a question or a comment. But one question I wanted to ask about the sutta, delight and meaning have been destroyed. And, you know, when you said, you know, there are times when you enjoy being a woman, and I guess I'm wondering about the use of the word delight, because delight seems to me like quite a lovely thing, very spiritual thing. So I'm wondering what the word in Pali is there. I mean, I could see if it said desire and being are destroyed, or craving and being are destroyed. But delight seems almost like a passive enjoyment of something that's wonderful. So yeah. I don't want to descend into the semantic, but I just kind of question.
Yeah, so I don't have the Pali in front of me, but there is a particular word that the Buddha used when he talked about delighting here and there. Delighting in things is what causes us to want to come back for them. You know, it's really that kind of delight that keeps us caught in samsara. That doesn't mean we don't appreciate the beauty, you know, like I've said many times, if you read the verses of the enlightened monks, the Theragata, there's all this like, I love the forest, even from Mahakasapa, the toughest guy ever, you know, I love this mountain. I love this mountain, the refrain on his verses, I love this mountain, and the beauty of it, and the call of the birds, and all of that, you know, so it's kind of like, well, there are those distinctions, those differences in the way we relate to things that either can, and this is the point, we need to observe, you know, is the way I'm relating to this causing more craving? Or is my way of relating to this lifting the heart?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what makes the difference. And it might be the same exact experience working well for one person or not for another, or well for me sometimes and not at others. So if my delight in being a nun or being a bhikkhuni or being a woman or whatever it is, you know, if that's helping me let go, then, you know, that's good. It's not good to look at that.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome, Neil. Adrian?
Yeah, thank you so much for this talk. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. So I really liked the idea of this male, female, or monastic option. But then I was also thinking that in the Sangha, it seems that it is very... there's monks and there, you know, males, and then there's females, and obviously there's the issues of bhikkhuni ordination and stuff. So, are there things in place for people who are non-binary who want to ordain? Because I know there are some monastics that identify as they them, but it seems that probably there isn't that much support or understanding there.
I think it's cooking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's cooking. I think there's. Yeah, growing understanding of how that might work, how that might be supported. And right now, I think the situation at some monasteries is, depending on your physical makeup, you go into one camp or the other. But your mental makeup might be whatever. So I don't, you know, it depends on the community and how comfortable they are with that. And you know, we just see how things unfold. But I think the more we're able and willing to explore these areas, you know, just our ability to support variety increases. That's how it looks to me. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be great. I've talked to, I don't know, 3 or 4 maybe now non-binary people who want to enter the Sangha. And I'm like, maybe we need a non-binary Sangha, which is a separate thing. And they can mash the rules for the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis however makes sense for their community and just like go with it. It's nice. It's not so restrictive and then you don't have to worry about any of the stuff. It's good, I think. We'll see what happens. I'm not up for leading it, though. Just saying.
Shh. She knows how that works. You come up with an idea, or worse, you come up with a complaint, and then it's in your lap.
I really like that idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good, because I know that at least the last two people I talked to recently are like really up for that. It sounds like the best kind of,
environment.
Yeah, like the safest feeling, most understanding kind of environment for them. Like they're all on the same page and know each other's struggles well enough to have the most support. So
yay!
So stay tuned.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.